Pluto cut him off, and I asked you where Major Brownlee is.
Sir, Major Brownlee, to the best of my knowledge, should be in Australia. He was under orders to report to General Pickering.
Well, I don't think he did, or General Pickering wouldn't have sent me down here in his car to meet him.
When was the last time you saw him?
In Hawaii, sir. At Hickam Field, he obtained passage for himself on a Flying Fortress.
When was that?
3 days ago, sir.
Before or after Sessions left?
Several hours afterward, sir.
Staff Sergeant Koffler, carrying Macklin's luggage, walked up.
Steve, how fast is a B-17 compared to a Coronado? Pluto asked.
About 80 miles an hour faster.
Why do you want to know?
Major Brownlee left Hawaii on a B-17 a couple of hours after Sessions, and he's not here yet.
That doesn't sound right, Koffler said.
I don't think so either.
My God, this Oriental major calls this sergeant by his first name, carries on a personal conversation with him, and seems blissfully oblivious to the fact that he hasn't said sir once to him.
You are some sort of expert, are you, sergeant, on aircraft?
Koffler shrugged modestly.
Oh, yeah, Pluto said. Steve is our resident expert. If it flies, he knows how fast and how far. And he's also a pretty good radio operator.
Tell that to the general, please, Koffler said.
You're not going, Steve, Pluto said. Give it up.
He turned to Macklin.
You might as well get in, Captain, since Brownlee's not here.
My orders are to report to General Pickering, Macklin said. Would you take me to him, please?
My orders from General Pickering are to set you up in the Sweepo BOQ. When he wants to see you, he'll send for you.
Top Secret, from Supreme Headquarters, Sweepo, 0925, 26 November 42, by Special Channel. To SyncPak, Hawaii. Eyes only, SyncPak. Duplication forbidden. Original to be destroyed after encryption and transmittal. Following personal from Brig Gen Pickering to Admiral Nimitz. Dear Admiral Nimitz, Major James C. Brownlee III, USMC, en route USMC Special Detachment 16 to participate in Fertig operation, believed to have departed Hickam Field as supercargo aboard U.S. Army Air Corps B-17, approximately 1830, 21 November 1942, has not arrived here. Request any and all information regarding this officer's location be furnished via special channel as soon as possible. Respectfully, Pickering. End personal from Brig Gen Pickering to Admiral Nimitz. By direction, Hong Sun Du, Major, Signal Corps, USA. Top Secret. 7. Headquarters, U.S. Forces in the Philippines, Davao Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines, 0705 hours, 28 November, 1942. Second Lieutenant Percy Lewis Everly, U.S. FIP, walked down the dirt trail through the bush very slowly, followed by the other 9 members of the patrol. His loose-fitting, dirty, white cotton blouse and trousers, cut off at the knees, were sweat-soaked and filthy. His calves were bloody where they had been scratched by thorns. Flies and other insects were feeding on the suppurating wounds. He carried a Thompson 45 ACP submachine gun in his hand. The leather straps of 3 Japanese Arasaka rifles and their leather accoutrements crossed his chest. Behind him came 2 Filipino soldiers, carrying between them what at first looked like a body suspended from a pole on their shoulders. It was not a body, but the tunic and trousers of a Japanese soldier stripped from his body and pressed into use as makeshift bags. The tunic held 2 5-gallon tin cans of gasoline, a total weight of 70 pounds. In the trousers was an estimated 50 pounds of rice, 20 pounds of Japanese canned goods, perhaps 10 or 15 more pounds of ammunition for the Arasakas, and an even dozen grenades. The load-bearers also carried U.S. Army caliber .30-06 Enfield rifles. Behind them came 3 more pairs of what Everly somewhat unkindly thought of as coolies, 2 more Filipinos and 4 Marines, also carrying captured food and equipment suspended in Japanese uniforms converted into bags. How the slight Filipinos managed their loads, Everly had no idea. It seemed to be a matter of pride with them to carry at least as much as the Marines.
Bringing up the rear was a Filipino making his painful way using a forked stick as a crutch. He had sprained, Everly suspected, broken his ankle in a fall just before they ambushed the Japanese vehicles. Somehow, he had managed to keep up with the others. They had been walking all night in the light of a half moon. Everly walked up to the small building on stilts that was both the G2 section, headquarters USFIP, and the quarters he shared with Captain James B. Weston. He turned and faced his men.
"Just drop that stuff where you are," he ordered. "Somebody will take care of it. Somebody go get the chief and have him look at Zappo's leg. Get something to eat and some sleep."
There were nods in acceptance of the orders, but no one responded out loud. They just lowered their loads onto the ground. Everly looked at the steps leading to the veranda of the house. Although he really disliked doing this, it was a mortal sin for a Marine, permitting weapons to touch the ground. He decided there was no way he could negotiate the stairs, loaded down as he was. He put the butt of the Thompson on the ground, leaning the barrel against his leg, and started to remove the leather straps around his chest. When he had the first one off and tried to lower it gently to the ground, the Thompson fell off his leg.
"Shit,"
he said, and angrily pulled the other straps over his head and let the rifles fall. Then he picked up the Thompson and brushed the dirt from it as well as he could. Then he slowly climbed the ladder-like stairs to the veranda. Captain Weston was not in the office of their quarters, the two rooms into which the house was divided.
"Fuck it," Everly said aloud to himself.
"He'll be back."
He walked to his bed, constructed of bamboo poles with a combination spring and mattress made of woven leaves, and lay down. He lay immobile for a minute or two, then sat up and took his boondockers and socks off. The socks were in tatters, and the sole of the right boondocker would not last much longer. It was about to tear free of the nearly rotten leather. He lay back down and considered that problem a moment. He had big feet, 11 1/2, and so far, no Japanese he had come across had feet nearly that big. The Filipinos were well shod, courtesy of the Japanese Imperial Army, but the footgear of all the Marines was just about shot. They were going to have to find a shoemaker, or something else would have to be done. The house shook, signaling that someone was climbing the stairs. Everly didn't move his head, but looked at the open door.
"Welcome home," Weston said.
Everly did not reply. He disapproved of Weston's beard. An officer should be shaved, not wearing a goatee like General Fertig, or a full beard like Weston.
"How did it go?" "We got some stuff, including 15 gallons of gas."
"I saw that," Weston interrupted.
"And I marked some stuff on a map,"
Everly said, reaching into his trousers pocket and handing it to Weston.
"We didn't lose anybody. Zappo hurt his ankle. It's probably broken. And I am down to 26 rounds for my Thompson."
"Good job, Everly," Weston said.
"How about a 3-day pass?" Everly said.
Weston chuckled.
"You just spent it on whiskey and wild women. You better believe it."
"We had an interesting message from Australia," Weston said.
"What did they say this time? Your request under advisement for a change?"
"Do you remember the name of the first sergeant of Baker Company, 4th Marines in China?"
"What?"
"The name of the first sergeant of Baker Company of the 4th Marines in China. Do you remember it?"
"How could I forget it? That fat fucker was one mean son of a bitch."
"What was his name?"
"It was..."
Everly began, and then drew a blank, even though he had a very clear mental image of First Sergeant...
"What the fuck is his name?"
standing with his hands on his hips, his beer belly straining the buttons of his stiffly starched khakis.
"Shit. I can't remember. I can see the son of a bitch. Why do you want to know?"
"Australia wants to use his name in a simple substitution code."
"What for?"
"I have no idea."
"Give me a minute. I'll think of it."
30 minutes later, he was still unable to call the name from memory. Although one of the other Marines vaguely remembered the first sergeant of Baker Company, 4th Marines, no one could come up with his name. By that time, Captain Weston and Lieutenant Everly had been joined by Lieutenant Ball, Captain Buchanan, and General Fertig.
"I'm sorry, General," Everly said. "Maybe if I stop trying so hard, maybe after I get some sleep, The problem, Lieutenant, is that I promised Australia I would respond today, Fertig said. General, I'm sorry, Everly repeated.
Those bastards are probably looking for an excuse to break off contact with us, Weston said, putting into words what was in the minds of everybody in the small room.
Captain, Fertig said sharply, please keep thoughts like that to yourself.
Sorry, sir.
Let's try another tack, Fertig said. Who would want this information? Why?
Everybody shrugged, but after a moment, Lieutenant Ball said, maybe they want to know if Everly is really Everly. I mean, the one who served with the 4th Marines.
What the hell is the difference? Let's go with Ball's idea. Unless he had also served with the 4th Marines, who else would know about this First Sergeant and know that Everly would know?
Anybody in the 4th Marines.
But this chap is in Australia, Fertig said. So it would be someone who served with the 4th Marines and did not come to the Philippines when they did.
The killer, Everly said.
What? And he would know about Zimmerman, Everly said, now excited. It's got to be the killer.
Who's the killer? Fertig asked.
Corporal Killer McCoy, Everly said. He used to work for Captain Banning, who was the S2 of the 4th. Him and Zimmerman were pals.
Fertig looked at Buchanan.
What have we got to lose, General? Captain Buchanan said.
Part 12. 1. Radio Room, Supreme Headquarters, SWEPO, 0910 hours, 28 November 1942.
You've got something for me?
Major Han Son-Du asked as he entered the crowded room.
I can't imagine who else it would be for, Major, said Captain Edward D'Alessandro, the somewhat prissy Signal Corps captain on duty.
Captain D'Alessandro had not stopped smarting under the injustice of a system that had suddenly promoted to field grade the Asiatic lieutenant with the mysterious duties that kept him off the duty roster, while he himself had been a captain with outstanding efficiency reports for nearly 18 months and was still waiting for his promotion. He handed Han the message.
It came in the clear, Captain D'Alessandro said, as Han read the brief message. MFS to GYB. Cannot recall fat bastard's name. The killer should know it. Remember the Kraut's name. Do you want it in the clear? Fertig, Brig Gen. MFS standing by.
Han smiled.
Call them back, please, Captain, he said. Message is, negative Kraut's name in clear. Stand by.
I think I have the right to know what this is all about, Captain D'Alessandro said. Highly irregular doesn't begin to cover it.
You don't have the right to know, Captain, Han said evenly, and reached for the telephone on the captain's desk.
General, this is Pluto, he said, and interrupted himself. Captain, reply to MFS now.
Yes, sir, Captain D'Alessandro said.
Sorry, I was interrupted. Sir, we've just heard from Fertig, addressed to the killer. I suggest, sir, that you send him and Sessions and the Model 94 here. I'm in the SWEPO radio room.
Captain D'Alessandro returned from responding to MFS.
We have an acknowledgement of your message to MFS, sir.
Thank you. We will be communicating with MFS some more. I'm going to need either your desk or a table, a typewriter, and several chairs.
I'm sure the Major is aware that he is disrupting my operation. I'm going to have to bring this to the attention of the SWEPO signal officer.
That's, Colonel Ungerer, sir, Colonel Jason Ungerer. I suggest, Captain, that you hold off on calling Colonel Ungerer for 10 or 15 minutes. By then, General Pickering will be here, and your boss and my boss can sort this disruption out between them.
2. Headquarters, U.S. Forces in the Philippines, Davao, Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines, 0940 hours, 28 November, 1942.
Lieutenant, Sergeant Ignacio Lamadrid said, Australia's calling.
I'll go get the general, Lieutenant Ball replied. He said he wanted to be here when they did.
Lamadrid turned to his key and tapped out, MFS to GYB, GA. Go ahead. Then he put his fingers on his typewriter keyboard and took the incoming message. When he was finished, he tapped out MFSSB, standing by, and then tore the carbon paper sandwich from the typewriter.
he laid the bottom sheet, on which the message was legible, on his desk, then placed a fresh sheet of blank paper under the carbon, arranged it neatly, and fed the fresh sandwich to his typewriter. Then he read the message from Supreme Headquarters, Southwest Pacific Ocean Area. GYB to MFS. Use as simple sub, stop, first name Banning, wife, stop, second name, stop, Percy's hometown, stop. Followed by a series of two-digit numbers, repeated. MFS SB. He had absolutely no idea what it meant, and neither, he quickly learned, did General Fertig, Captain Buchanan, and Lieutenant Ball. Except, of course, that Captain Buchanan knew Australia wanted them to use a simple substitution code. Ball, go get Captain Weston and Lieutenant Everly, Buchanan ordered. They appeared within minutes, Everly's clean-shaven face and clean, if water-soaked, white cotton blouse and jacket indicating he had been summoned from his toilet in the stream that ran through the command post of United States forces in the Philippines.
I think this is intended for you, Lieutenant, Fertig said. You have any idea what it means?
Banning's wife's name is Lyudmila Zhivkov, Everly said almost immediately. There aren't many people who know that. Killer McCoy would be one of them.
That sounds Russian, Fertig thought aloud.
It is, Everly said. She's a Russian refugee. She didn't get out of Shanghai. Neither did my wife. They're together. That's how I know Miller's name.
How do you spell it? Captain Buchanan asked, sitting down at the rattan desk. As Everly spelled the name, Buchanan wrote each letter as a large block letter, then asked Everly what his hometown was, and wrote those letters down in large letters. Above the letters, he carefully wrote numerals.
Okay, now we have the code. Somebody read out those numbers to me, slowly.
General Fertig read out the numbers from the message one at a time, moving to stand behind Buchanan as he did so. When Buchanan was finished, he had this. S over 20, E over 19, N over 18, D over 03, Z over 09. K over 13, Z over 09, A over 08, U over 02, T over 09. S over 20, Z over 09, N over 18, A over 17, M over 04. E over 19, S over 20, Z over 09, Z over 09, Z over 09.
What the hell does that mean?
Fertig asked, bewildered and annoyed.
General, the Z is a wild card. You'll notice they used Z's as sentence breaks in the original message.
Fertig was ahead of him.
Send Kraut's name, he translated.
I believe that's names, sir, plural, Buchanan said.
Who's the Kraut, Everly?
Fertig asked.
Zimmerman, Everly said. What the hell was his first name?
Not again, Everly, please, Weston said.
August, Everly said,
and then triumphantly,
no, Ernest Zimmerman.
You're sure?
Yes, sir.
Send them that,
Fertig ordered. It took just over a minute for Buchanan to encode the name and to hand it to Sergeant Lamadrid with the order, just send the numbers, send them twice.
Yes, sir,
Lamadrid said, and tapped out the reply on his radio telegraph key. MFS to GYB. 19-09-18-25-20, 09-09-05-04-04, 19-09-04-17-18. Then repeated the series, MFS-SB. There was an immediate reply from Australia. GYB to MFS, AC-YER-NO-1-SB. Sergeant Lamadrid read it aloud, translated it as it came in.
Acknowledge receipt, your message number one, stand by.
What's that message number business? Fertig asked.
They've never done that before.
I think that until about 30 seconds ago, sir, Weston said, Australia thought Lamadrid spelled his name T-O-J-O.
Here comes another one,
Lamadrid said, and this time, as he typed, he called the numbers out loud.
04, 19, 01, 06, 20, 25, 19, 09, 14, 02, 20, 14, 14, 18, 13, 11, 06, 07, 19, 09.
Buchanan had already begun the decoding before the numbers were repeated. He handed it to General Fertig.
What the hell do you suppose Melz Izu Sunk Illes means? Fertig asked softly.
Sir? Buchanan said, his voice tight. I believe it means we'll see you soon, signature killer.
He looked over at Lieutenant Everly.
What do you make of it, Everly?
Yes, sir. I think that's what it means. Zimmerman and the killer. I'd say it means they're coming in.
It doesn't say that, General Fertig said.
What else could it mean, sir?
Everly asked, and then excitedly added,
Quentin Alexander McPherson! Fucking Quentin fucking Alexander fucking McPherson!
What? General Fertig asked. I believe Lieutenant Everly's memory has returned, sir, Captain Weston said. 3. Office of the Kempe Thai Commander for Mindanao, Cagayan de Oro, Misamis Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines. 10:50 hours, 28 November, 1942.
Sir, these messages between Fertig and Australia were intercepted within the past hour,
Lieutenant Hideyori Niigata said, and laid a manila folder on Captain Matsuo Saikaku's desk. When Saikaku finished examining them and looked up at Hideyori, Hideyori added,
They have been forwarded to Signals Intelligence in Manila, sir.
And how soon may we expect to have a decryption from them?
Sir, there is no way of telling.
You have advised them, of course, of Kempe Thai's interest in this, that this matter is to have a high priority.
Yes, sir, of course. Sir, may I ask how familiar the captain is with simple substitution encryption?
I am always willing, Hideyori, to add to my knowledge.
The difficulty in decoding simple substitution encryption, sir, arises because the sender and the receiver have access to information the interceptor does not.
Explain that, please.
The captain will notice that the sender is telling the receiver to use the first and second names of Banning's wife and the hometown of Percy. The receiver will write that information in a line and then write numbers from 0, 1 through how many letters there are in the names.
Hideyori saw the confusion on Saikaku's face.
Sir, perhaps it might be a good idea if I demonstrate it?
Please do, Saikaku said.
The demonstration took about 5 minutes. When it was finished, Captain Saikaku was aware of the difficulty the signals intelligence people would have decoding the message.
What this means is that we stand virtually no chance of decoding this message?
Oh, no, sir. The signals intelligence people are quite clever and have developed several techniques that will permit them eventually to decode these messages. But, unfortunately, that's likely going to take some time.
How much time? Saikaku asked coldly. 2 days? A week? A month?
If I had to guess, sir, I would say 5 days to a week.
Splendid! Saikaku said sarcastically.
Sir, I had some thoughts.
What kind of thoughts?
Sir, I am sure that someone like yourself, an officer at the Kempe Thai, almost certainly has already...
The one thing you learn in the Kempe Thai, Hideyori, is never to give in to the temptation not to turn over the last rock. For it is often under that last rock that you find what you are looking for. Please go on.
Sir, I have noticed that there seems to be a question of the legitimacy of this General Fertig and of his U.S. forces in the Philippines.
He's a bandit, Hideyori. By definition, bandits are illegitimate.
Sir, I was speaking of his legitimacy in the eyes of the Americans in Australia.
Go on.
I am sure the captain noticed the next-to-last message.
What about it?
It says, sir, GYB... The Australian station says, At your no one. That means, we acknowledge receipt of your message number one. And then it orders them, SB, stand by. That never happened before. It seems to me, sir, that it could mean acceptance in Australia that Fertig is who he says he is. In other words, it could be official recognition.
And of course it could mean nothing at all, Saikaku said.
But that was very clever of you, Hideyori. In the future, please give me all of your thoughts.
It will be my pleasure, sir.
4. Top Secret, from Sinkpak, Hawaii, 1615, 28 November 42. Eyes only, Brig Gen Fleming Pickering, USMC. Duplication forbidden. Original to be destroyed after encryption and transmittal. Following personal from Sinkpak to Brig Gen Pickering, USMC. Dear Fleming. 1. Deeply regret to inform you information from Commanding General Hawaii Department U.S. Army Air Corps indicates Major James C. Brownlee III, USMC, departed Hickam Field as supercargo aboard U.S. Army Air Corps B-17, tail number 42-455502, destination Midway. Aircraft encountered mechanical difficulties apparently result of severe weather approximately 215 nautical miles northeast of Midway. Personnel aboard other B-17 aircraft in flight of 7 report 42-455502 crashed and broke up attempting ditching operation in heavy seas approximately 07:25 hours local time 22 November 1942. No survivors were seen at time of ditching, and Navy and U.S. Army Air Corps aircraft which flew to crash site when weather cleared 23 November found neither survivors nor crash debris. 2. Commanding General Hawaii Department U.S. Army Air Corps has determined B-17 aircraft 42-455502, its crew and passenger, perished in the line of duty 07:30 hours midway time 22 November 1942. Inasmuch as Air Corps does not have information regarding Major Brownlee's unit, routine notification of next of kin, etc. has not, repeat, not been made. Please advise soonest how you wish this to be handled. 3. Rear Admiral Daniel J. Wagum of my staff departed Pearl Harbor 1625 this date to confer with Supreme Commander Sweepo. While in Brisbane, he will discuss with you problems connected with submarine availability. Compliance with 17 November directive from Admiral Leahy in this regard, which I presume you have seen, will be very difficult for reasons Wagum will make known to you. Best personal regards, Chester. End personal from Admiral Nimitz to Brig Gen Fertig. By direction, McNish, Captain USN. Top Secret. 5. Water Lily Cottage, Brisbane, Australia. 0610 hours, 29 November 1942. Brigadier General Fleming Pickering found First Lieutenant Kenneth R. McCoy in the library, sitting before a typewriter at one of the desks, obviously deep in thought. Or frustration. The long, thin, black cigar in his mouth seemed cocked at an angry angle. "Am I interrupting, Ken?" Pickering asked. In one smooth, continuous movement, McCoy rose to his feet, snatched the cigar from his mouth, and came to something like the prescribed position of attention. "Good morning, sir," he said. He was, Pickering noticed, clean-shaven. His haircut was perfect, and he was wearing a fresh uniform. "No, sir." "Typewriter giving you trouble?" Pickering had sent Pluto out to buy typewriters for Water Lily Cottage on the open market. After getting them from the officer in charge of office equipment at Sweepo seemed more trouble than it was worth. The battered Underwoods Pluto found had cost approximately 3 times what they had cost new 10 years before. Australia had been at war since 1940. Despite official price controls, shortages of practically everything but food had driven prices up. "It seemed better days, sir. I heard the typewriter, the noise, and thought you could probably use some coffee," Pickering said, holding up a silver coffee pot in one hand and 2 coffee cups in the other. And then he told the truth. "I'd like to talk to you, Ken." "Yes, sir." "But it will hold. Finish what you're doing." "This will hold," McCoy said. "It's only a letter to Ernie." "Only a letter to Ernie?" Pickering parroted. "That's not important anymore?" McCoy reached into his open collar and came out with a round silver medallion on a silver chain. "I'm writing a thank you for this," he said. "I really don't know what to say." "What is it?" "It's an Episcopal serviceman's cross," McCoy said. "It was in that package Sessions brought me."
"You're Episcopal?"
"I'm not much of anything. Most people hear McCoy think it's Irish and that I'm Catholic. But I'm Scotch, and that's Presbyterian, and I never had much to do with them."
"Ernie's Episcopal," Pickering said.
"So am I."
"Would you believe that Pick sang in the choir, that he was an altar boy?"
"Pick's behind this," McCoy said.
Charlie Galloway's girlfriend sent him one. Pick saw Galloway's on the Buka operation and decided he wanted one. He wrote and asked his mother for one. She told Ernie's mother told Ernie, and here is mine. It came in a little red velvet bag with Tiffany and Company printed on it.
Well, I think it's a very nice gesture. It can't hurt, Ken.
He paused and then went on.
You're not religious? Is that the problem?
No. I believe in God, I suppose. But I think there's a lot of guys in graves on Guadalcanal and in the Philippines who did a lot of hard praying just before they were blown away.
I have my problems with organized religion, Pickering said. But I'm a sailor. I don't see how anyone who has counted the stars on a clear night on the high seas or watched the sun come up in the middle of an ocean can doubt the existence of a superior power.
McCoy chuckled.
Me either. My problem is that I really don't believe that God is all that interested in Ken McCoy, personally.
Did you pray when you were hit? Pickering asked.
McCoy shook his head no.
But I said thank you when I got back to Washington and Ernie was waiting for me. I said thank you when El Supremo told me VMF 229 was relieved on the canal and that Pick had come through all right. And when you all came back from Buka in one piece.
Not when you got hit? McCoy asked.
You mean this time? Pickering asked, and then went on before McCoy could reply. I suppose I did. I probably did. I don't really remember. At my age, you say, thank you for other people's lives. I figure I've had my fair share and more.
McCoy looked at him in curiosity.
I didn't really expect to come back from France, Pickering said. When I did, when I came out of the trenches for the last time, I figured whatever came afterward would be gravy. And it turned out that way.
It was bad in France, huh?
The artillery was terrible, Pickering said evenly, especially when we were moving. But what really terrified me was the poison gas. I watched people die that way. I didn't want that to happen to me. That thought scared me bad.
McCoy nodded his understanding.
I'm not particularly afraid of dying, McCoy said. What scares me is dying slowly, hanging upside down on a rope while some Jap uses me for bayonet practice.
They do that?
Sometimes they use their rifle butts to see how many bones they can break before the prisoner dies.
Pickering nodded his understanding.
You said you wanted to talk to me, sir?
The exchange of confidences was over.
I'm going to have to ask you to go into the Philippines, Ken, Pickering said.
McCoy nodded.
I figured that when I heard we lost the OSS major.
I think we have to do whatever we can to help Fertig and his people.
Yes, sir, I agree.
I wish the other one had been on the B-17, Pickering said.
McCoy chuckled.
The thought occurred to me too, General.
But he didn't, and I was going to come to you, sir, and tell you that I thought I'd better go with them, even before I heard the B-17 went down.
It's still a volunteer mission, Ken. You don't have to go.
Who else is there? McCoy replied.
Is that why you're having a hard time with your letter to Ernie? Pickering asked. You wrote and told her you would be coming home, and now you have to write and tell her you won't be?
McCoy met Pickering's eyes.
I was pretty vague about when I was coming home. Getting relieved seemed to be too good to be true.
I'll have a word with Captain Macklin and tell him who's really in charge.
I can handle Macklin.
Have you seen him?
No, sir. I've been avoiding that.
How are you going to handle him?
If I have to, I'll kill him.
Pickering looked into McCoy's eyes. It would be awkward if that was necessary.
I won't, unless I have to.
Anything I can do?
I want Zimmerman, and I don't want Koffler.
Because it would be unfair to Koffler?
Because he wants to be an officer, and I'm afraid he thinks the way he can do that is to be a hero. Heroes get people killed.
They're working on Zimmerman. There's an admiral coming in today from SyncPAC who wants to talk about the submarine. I don't think we can get one for another week or 10 days. Zimmerman certainly should be here by then.
It'll take me another 5-6 days to get everything ready anyhow.
Pluto has been having trouble getting a radio operator from Suipo. I'm going to El Supremo this morning to ask him personally. I think he'll come through.
McCoy nodded.
I really hate having to ask you to go, Ken.
I really hate to go, McCoy said.
But there's no other solution that I can see.
Pickering met McCoy's eyes. They held for a moment, then Pickering nodded and started out of the library. Over his shoulder, he called,
"Tell Ernie I said hello."
6. Cryptographic Center, Supreme Headquarters, Southwest Pacific Ocean Area, 0905 hours, 29 November, 1942. When Major Hong Son-du slid open the tiny steel window in the steel door and saw Brigadier General Fleming Pickering's face, he knew that something had happened that Pickering didn't like at all. He slid the bars out of place and pulled the heavy door inward.
"I didn't expect to see you here, sir."
"I have just come from the throne of God," Pickering said. "I humbly requested an audience with El Supremo, and, feeling gracious, he granted me one."
When there was no elaboration on this, Pluto went to one of the two typewriters on the desk and jerked a sheet of paper from it.
"Is this about what you want, sir?"
Pickering took the sheet of paper from him and read it. "Top secret. Supreme Headquarters, Sweepo, time, 29 November 42. Eyes only, the Secretary of the Navy, by a special channel. Duplication forbidden. Original to be destroyed after encryption and transmittal. 2. SecNave. Dear Frank, I deeply regret having to inform you that I have just learned from Admiral Nimitz that Major Brownlee died in the crash of an airplane as he was coming here. These are the details as I got them from Admiral Nimitz. Brownlee departed Hickam Field as supercargo aboard U.S. Army Air Corps B-17, tail number 42-455502. The aircraft encountered mechanical difficulties apparently result of severe weather approximately 250 nautical miles northeast of Midway. Personnel aboard other B-17 aircraft reported Brownlee's B-17 crashed and broke up, attempting ditching operation in heavy seas approximately 0725 hours local time, 22 November 1942. Inasmuch as no survivors were seen at time of ditching, and Navy and U.S. Army Air Corps aircraft which flew to crash site when weather cleared 23 November found neither survivors nor crash debris, Commanding General Hawaii Department U.S. Army Air Corps has determined all perished in the line of duty. I presume you or Donovan will handle notification of next of kin and other administrative matters. Captains Session and Macklin and all equipment arrived here safely, and at this time it is not believed Major Brownlee's tragic death will affect the mission. Best regards, Fleming Pickering, Brigadier General USMCR, Top Secret.
Take out the Dear Frank and make it Dear Mr. Secretary, Pickering ordered, and delete the best regards. I don't feel like calling the son of a bitch by his first name, and I don't want to send him my regards.
Yes, sir.
And send an information copy, eyes only, to Admiral Nimitz.
Yes, sir.
Pluto, in one word, what would be your reaction if someone told you that Sweepo doesn't have a high-speed radio operator they can give us for the Fairtig operation?
One word, sir?
The one word that came to my mind was bullshit, Pickering said.
You got that from El Supremo?
3 minutes ago.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to have to send Koffler. What else can I do?
I can't see where you have any other option, sir.
I had a very unpleasant suspicion when I was in the throne room that very few tears would be shed by El Supremo and his cronies if our guys paddled away from the submarine and were never heard from again.
Pluto decided that any response to that remark would be the wrong one.
General, what about what Admiral Nimitz said, his 17 November directive about a submarine from Admiral Leahy?
I never heard a word about it, Pickering said. Until I do, I am forced to draw the conclusion that either Knox or Donovan has decided I don't have the need to know.
I'm sure this Admiral Wagham that Nimitz is sending will bring you in on it, sir.
I wish I was sure, Pluto, Pickering said.
Well,
get those off as soon as you can. I'm going to go out to the house and weep on Jack Stecker's shoulder.
7. Company Grade Bachelor Officer's Quarters, Supreme Headquarters, Southwest Pacific Ocean Area, 11:05 hours, 29 November 1942. Captain Robert B. Macklin, USMC, was resting, his back against the headboard of the bed of the sparsely furnished room, half asleep,
a 3-month-old issue of the Saturday Evening Post open on his lap. Before the war, this BOQ had been a second- or third-rate traveling salesman's hostelry. He couldn't help making unfavorable comparisons between his room and the mess here with the rooms and mess at the country club, which was much nicer than even the hotel rooms and restaurants he'd been in all up and down the West Coast during the war bond tours. Last night, at the bar, he had drinks with an Army Chemical Warfare Service captain, and the captain told him the SWEPO field grade officers' BOQs were much nicer than the company grade. He knew, because until he was ranked out of it, he had been living in a field-grade BOQ. That encounter triggered several lines of thought. First, that when Major Brownlee finally showed up, perhaps he could pull a string or two and arrange for them both to live in a field-grade BOQ. Second, he wondered how this OSS assignment would affect his own promotion to Major. Major Brownlee's quiet word in the right ear had seen his long-overdue promotion to captain come through almost overnight. Next, Macklin found it hard to believe that whoever was in charge here would actually send him on this Philippines operation. For one thing, he had not really fully recovered from his wounds. For another, he had not gone through the OSS training program and knew very little of what would be expected of him on such a mission. Nor did he yet possess the skills to do whatever it was he'd be required to do. When that became obvious to whoever was in charge here, he felt he would almost certainly be kept in Australia to receive the necessary training, and to fully recover from his wounds, and would not be sent into the Philippines. It did not seem unreasonable to think that when the OSS force here was eventually augmented, since he was already here, he would be an old hand, and could take over as a training officer to train the newcomers. It seemed only fair that people who had not been in combat should be sent on missions before those who had seen combat, had been twice wounded in combat, were sent into harm's way again. And he knew that Major Brownlee was concerned with his lack of training and his physical condition. The reason Brownlee took the one available space on the B-17 was that he thought he could take the physical stress of that flight better. The knock at his door startled him. He sat fully up on the bed.
"Who is it?"
"Colonel Stecker's compliments, sir," a young American voice replied. Macklin lifted himself off the bed, opened the door, and peered around it. It was the boy-faced sergeant who spoke so flippantly to him on the quay 3 days before.
"What is it, sergeant?"
"Colonel Stecker's compliments, sir. He sent me to fetch you."
Who in the wide world is Colonel Stecker? That name never came up in any of the briefings.
"Who is Colonel Stecker?"
"Colonel Jack NMI Stecker, Captain," the sergeant replied, and then, smiling, added, "The NMI means no middle initial."
"You find that amusing, Sergeant?"
"Colonel Stecker is probably General Pickering's deputy or chief of staff, something like that."
"I think it's sort of interesting."
"You think it's sort of interesting, sir," Macklin corrected him.
"Yes, sir."
"I'll be with you shortly," Macklin snapped.
"I'll wait for you in the jeep, Captain," the sergeant said. Except for his subtly disrespectful attitude, there was nothing he could find in the sergeant's behavior to put a finger on, but his behavior was definitely annoying. He was reminded of the behavior of Corporal McCoy in China, and after a moment, he decided that was probably the explanation. McCoy was here, McCoy was an officer, and young enlisted men tended to emulate the behavior of their officers. He hadn't seen McCoy. He hadn't seen anyone or heard from anyone since the Asiatic major dumped him at the BOQ shortly after his arrival. Walking home from the 0800 morning prayer service at St. John's Church that morning, he'd decided that if he didn't hear anything by 1700, he would telephone the OSS people here in Brisbane. He rather enjoyed the worship service, the familiar hymns and the words of the Book of Common Prayer in a church not unlike his own St. Paul's were rather nice. Afterward, as he waited in line to shake the rector's hand, he chatted with a stocky, well-dressed gentleman with a large mustache who asked him to join him and his family for Sunday dinner if he had no other plans. He had no other plans, of course, except to return to the BOQ and wait for something to happen. But he did not think he should run the risk of being away from the BOQ should Major Brownlee suddenly appear, so he declined, telling the kind gentleman that he had duty.
but the encounter had tipped the scales in favor of calling the OSS station in Brisbane. He had been furnished and had memorized their number for emergency purposes. He wasn't sure whether this was an emergency or not, but certainly the OSS would be interested to hear that he had not heard from anyone, most importantly from Major Brownlee, in 72 hours. He checked his reflected image as well as he could in the dim mirror over the wash basin, tugged at the hem of his tunic, and then, carefully locking the door behind him, walked down the long, dark, and narrow corridor of the hotel, down the creaking stairs, across the sparsely furnished lobby, and outside. The sergeant saw him coming, started the jeep's engine, and waited for him to get in. Somewhat impatiently, Macklin thought. It was apparent the sergeant hadn't even considered stepping out of the jeep, saluting, and then waiting for the officer to be seated before getting behind the wheel. "What is our destination, sergeant?" he asked, as Koffler backed the jeep away from its parking spot.
"We're going out to the cottage, captain."
"And what is the cottage, sergeant?"
"Where the officers live, captain."
"If the officers live there, why am I living in the company-grade B.O.Q.?" When they arrived at the cottage, Macklin's first reaction was favorable. It could be something like the country club, he decided, a rather nice civilian facility requisitioned for the use of the OSS. That view was reinforced when the sergeant opened the door for him and motioned him inside, past an entrance hall and into a large, comfortably furnished living room. Two young Marine officers, both second lieutenants, slid their rattan upholstered chairs closer to a coffee table as a middle-aged woman in an apron, obviously some kind of servant, entered the room carrying a tray on which were a silver coffee set and a plate of pastries. Both officers looked at him curiously, but neither rose to his feet.
"I am Captain Macklin to see Colonel Stecker."
"Steve will tell him you're here, Captain," one of the officers, a tall, good-looking blonde, said. Steve is apparently this baby-faced sergeant who needs a refresher course in military courtesy, as do both of these young officers. Macklin saw the purple heart ribbon among those on the blonde's tunic. The other second lieutenant's tunic carried the silver cords identifying an aide-de-camp to a general officer.
"Is General Pickering here?" Macklin asked.
"Why don't you sit down and have a cup of coffee and a donut?" the aide-de-camp said.
"I'm sure Colonel Stecker will be ready for you in a minute or two."
"I asked you if General Pickering was here, Lieutenant," Macklin flared. "I am under orders to report to him."
Lieutenant George Hart looked at Macklin long enough for Macklin to realize he would not get an answer and to consider his next options. He was not forced to make a decision.
"The Colonel will see you now, Captain," Sergeant Koffler announced.
Macklin looked at him. He was standing by an open door. And then First Lieutenant Kenneth R. McCoy came through the door in the act of stuffing an M1911 A145 Colt under his belt in the small of his back. He looked at Macklin, meeting his eyes.
"Captain Macklin?" he said.
"McCoy?"
Macklin responded. McCoy looked away.
"Anybody want to see how much a lot of gold actually weighs?" McCoy said to no one in particular.
"Yeah, I would," the tall lieutenant said.
"I await my master's call," the aide-de-camp said.
"Damn it."
What can I use for wheels?" McCoy asked.
"You better take the Jaguar," the aide said. "The boss is either going to the palace to meet some admiral, or I'm going to the palace to bring the admiral here, and I know the colonel's going to need his jeep."
"In here, please, Captain," a new voice said. Macklin followed the sound and saw a tall, muscular, tanned, full colonel motioning him to enter the room McCoy had just left.
"Yes, sir," Macklin said.
"Did they offer you some coffee, Captain? Would you like some?"
"That would be very nice, sir."
"You better take somebody with you, Ken," the colonel said. "That's a lot of gold. I'd hate to have to tell somebody we lost it in a stick-up. And take the Jaguar, not the jeep."
"Gimpy's volunteered to ride shotgun, Colonel," McCoy said, nodding toward the tall second lieutenant.
"Any reason you can't go with them, George?"
Stecker asked.
"I'm waiting to see what the boss wants to do, Colonel."
"You go with them. If the general needs wheels, I'll drive him."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"Colonel, we're only going to take it from the bank to the dungeon, wrap it, and take it back to the bank," McCoy said.
"It's better to be safe than sorry,"
Stecker said with a smile. Write that down, McCoy.
Aye, aye, sir.
Okay, Captain, Stecker said. Get yourself a cup of coffee and then come in the library.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
As he poured coffee, Macklin understood why McCoy had referred to the tall second lieutenant as Gimpy. He walked with a visible limp and was apparently in some pain. Typical of McCoy to mock an officer who had suffered honorable wounds in combat. One more reason people like that should not be officers. Carrying his coffee and a sweet roll in his hands, Macklin went into the library. Colonel Stecker was at the door.
Take a seat, Captain Macklin, Stecker ordered, and then closed and locked the door behind them.
Macklin sat down in an upholstered armchair near the desk. Stecker walked to the desk and rested his rump on it.
I'm afraid there's been some bad news, Captain, he said. The B-17 carrying Major Brownlee was forced to ditch at sea near Midway. There were no survivors.
Macklin felt a chill.
My God, if I had been fully recovered from my wounds, I would have been aboard that B-17.
I'm very sorry to hear that, sir. Major Brownlee was a fine gentleman, a fine Marine officer.
So I have been led to believe.
Officially, that places command of the Fertig mission in your hands, Stecker said.
My God.
Colonel, may I inquire if the OSS has been notified of this terrible loss?
General Pickering notified Secretary Knox and asked that the information be relayed to the OSS.
I'm sure they will issue new instructions, Macklin said, half thinking aloud and only at the last second remembering to add, Sir.
Why should they do that? Stecker asked.
Colonel, the cold facts are that I am not qualified in terms of training or experience or physically. I was wounded at Gavutu with the 2nd Parachute Battalion and am not yet fully recovered to command such a mission.
God, Stecker said, loathing in his voice. I was half prepared to give you the benefit of the doubt. But you haven't changed at all, have you, Macklin?
Sir?
Do I look familiar to you, Captain?
No, sir, I don't believe I've previously had the privilege of the Colonel's acquaintance.
The first time we met was at Quantico, Captain. You were at the time engaged in several slimy schemes to keep McCoy from getting a commission.
Sir, I have no idea.
The second time we met was on Gavutu. I commanded 2nd Battalion 5th Marines during the invasion. I went to the aid station to see some of my men, and the battalion surgeon of the 2nd Parachute Battalion pointed out to me the officer his corpsman had to pry loose from a pier piling. You were a disgrace to the Corps on that occasion, too, Captain Macklin.
Sir, the only thing I can say is that the Colonel has been grossly misinformed.
Shut your lying mouth, Captain,
Stecker said almost conversationally.
Open it again only when I give you specific permission.
He looked at Macklin for a full minute before continuing.
For a number of reasons that are none of your concern, though they include General Pickering's belief that the Corps has a deep responsibility to do all it can to assist the Marines with General Fertig, the mission will proceed with you as its nominal commander. He has so informed Secretary Knox and thus the OSS. Actual command of the mission will be vested in Lieutenant McCoy. If I were McCoy, you would not leave the beach in the Philippines alive. Not because of your actions toward him at Quantico, but because a lying coward like you threatens both the lives of the men on this mission and the mission itself. Do I make myself clear, Captain Macklin?
Sir, I must protest in the strongest possible terms your characterization of... With a swift, seemingly effortless motion, Stecker leaned down to Macklin, grabbed his necktie, and pulled him half out of the chair.
My God, he's going to spit in my face.
As quickly as he had pulled Macklin from his chair, Stecker shoved him back into it.
You have one chance of coming out of this mission alive, Macklin, he said, his voice and his temper back under control. And that is to do exactly what McCoy tells you to do when he tells you to do it. You are 2 inches away from me ordering McCoy to remove you as a threat to the mission the moment you touch the beach in the Philippines. Do you understand me, Captain Macklin? Answer yes, sir, or no, sir.
Yes, sir.
Sergeant Crofter will now return you to the BOQ. You will stay there, prepared to make yourself available at any time McCoy feels he needs you.
As soon as I get out of here, I'm going to get in touch with the USS. This is outrageous.
The proper response to an order, Captain, is aye, aye, sir.
Aye, aye, sir, Captain Macklin said.
8. Conference Room 2, Supreme Headquarters, Suipo, Brisbane, Australia. 12:25 hours, 29 November, 1942.
Right this way, General, if you please. Lieutenant Chambers D. Lewis III, USN, aide-de-camp to Rear Admiral Daniel J. Wagham, USN, said to Brigadier General Fleming Pickering, USMC, as he pushed open the door. Then he raised his hand to block the passage of Second Lieutenant George F. Hart, USMCR, and added, "I believe, sir, with your permission, that the Admiral would prefer to confer in private."
"Oh, George goes everywhere with me, Lieutenant," Pickering replied. "That way we can both recall who said what to whom in one of these meetings."
It was obvious that Lieutenant Lewis did not like that response. This, Pickering decided, was fine with him because he did not like what little he had seen of Lewis. The first moment Pickering saw him, he concluded he was a self-important young man. It was not a surprise to see an Annapolis ring on his finger.
"Yes, sir, of course," Lieutenant Lewis said.
Just before noon, Lewis had appeared, unannounced, at Waterlily Cottage. When the doorbell rang, Pickering was close to it, so he opened it. It was clear from Lewis's face that he was a little surprised that a general officer would open his own door.
"General Pickering?"
Lewis asked, and when Pickering nodded, went on,
"Admiral Wagham's compliments, sir. I am the Admiral's aide-de-camp."
"I've been expecting to hear from him."
"Admiral Wagham would be pleased if it were convenient for the General to meet with him at Supreme Headquarters," Lewis said. "General Willoughby has been kind enough to offer accommodations."
"When?"
"Admiral Wagham hopes that it would be convenient for the General now, sir."
"Why not?"
Pickering thought aloud. And then, somewhat annoyed with himself, two thoughts came. First, this was really a summons. If the circumstances were reversed, he would have personally called Nimitz's admiral. He wouldn't have had Hart call him. And second, he didn't like Willoughby putting his 2 cents in. He turned and saw Jack Stecker.
"General Willoughby," he explained, "has kindly provided a place for Admiral Wagham and me to meet, and the admiral sent his aide to fetch me."
"Really?"
Stecker replied, both his tone of voice and his face showing that he read the situation exactly as Pickering did. Pickering turned back to Lewis.
"Where exactly are these accommodations, Lieutenant?"
"One of the conference rooms at Supreme Headquarters, sir."
"Please present my compliments to the Admiral, Lieutenant, and tell him I'm on my way."
"General, I have a car."
"So do I, Lieutenant," Pickering said. "Jack, is George in the dungeon by now, do you think?"
"Yes, sir, I would think so."
"Call the dungeon, please, Jack, and ask George to meet me in the lobby."
"Aye, aye, sir,"
Stecker said with a smile.
As Lewis held open the door for him now, Pickering remembered that he was perversely pleased at Lieutenant Lewis's obvious confusion in Waterlily Cottage.
Who was George, and what was the dungeon?
Lieutenant Lewis then announced him.
"Admiral? Brigadier General Pickering."
Admiral Wagham rose, smiling, from his chair at the head of the table. He was a tall, handsome, silver-haired officer in a well-fitting, high-collared white uniform.
"General Pickering," he said, putting out his hand. "Thank you for coming on such short notice."
"I realize that you're a busy man, Admiral," Pickering replied.
"But I don't like this. I don't like you sitting at the head of the table. No one has appointed you chairman of this conference, and I don't like being summoned here, no matter how politely your aide phrased it."
"General Willoughby was kind enough to offer us this place for our talk,"
Wagham said.
"He said you have declined the offer of an office at Suipo?"
"How kind of General Willoughby," Pickering said.
"Yes, I did. If I took an office here, I thought it might look as if I were a member of the Suipo staff."
When he saw that Wagham was taken a little aback by the remark, Pickering added, with a smile,
I didn't want to wind up on some sweepo duty roster, flag officer of the day or some such. Wagham chuckled.
Your precise status is the subject of some conversation, Wagham said.
The two men were evaluating each other.
So I understand, Pickering said.
The truth was, he liked his first impression of Wagham. This at first surprised him, until he reminded himself that he really liked and admired Admiral Chester Nimitz, for whom Admiral Wagham worked. He doubted that Nimitz would tolerate a fool on his staff for more than 60 seconds. That triggered the thought, the realization that he was in a lousy mood, and he knew the reasons for that. He didn't want to send McCoy into the Philippines at all, much less with the albatross of Macklin hanging around his neck. And he didn't want to send Koffler along with him either, even if he had no choice. El Supremo had refused to give him a qualified radio operator.
I'm just a simple sailor, Admiral, sailing in uncharted waters, Pickering said. You're an any tonnage, any ocean master mariner, General, Wagham said. Not a simple sailor. I'm sure that you can navigate safely through any array of rocks and shoals.
Pickering was surprised, and somehow pleased, that Wagham knew that he had spent time on the bridge of a ship. When I use somebody else's room, I always worry whether or not there's hidden microphones, Pickering said, now smiling. Wagham's face showed his confusion. He wasn't sure at first if Pickering was serious or not.
You think the Japanese have placed a microphone in here?
I'm not sure about the Japanese, he said, and switched to a thick but credible German accent.
But, the Germans,
he pronounced it, Germans,
you have to watch out for them.
Wagham had picked up on the smile. He smiled back. Despite the English-sounding name, General Charles Willoughby had a Germanic background and sometimes spoke with a perceptible German accent.
Really?
Wagham said.
If Charlie Willoughby does have a microphone in here, and I wouldn't put it past him, come to think of it, that should ruin his whole day, Pickering thought, pleased.
They're Germans, Pickering went on. They are not too smart, but they are thorough.
Wagham laughed out loud. Would the Admiral be kind enough to join me for lunch at a place where I know there are no microphones?
Yes, of course.
Thank you.
George, call out to the cottage and tell Mrs. Cavendish 4 for lunch as soon as we get there.
Aye, aye, sir.
I'll drive the Admiral in the Studebaker and you bring Lieutenant Lewis with you, Pickering ordered, and then had another thought. And I think it would be a good idea to drop by the dungeon and ask the killer to join us. Would that pose a problem?
No, sir. They're just about through, General.
Tell him to leave the gold there and then take it back after lunch.
Aye, aye, sir.
Admiral Nimitz told me to be careful if General Willoughby asked about Operation Windmill, Admiral Wagham said when they were in the Studebaker. But do...
About Operation what? Pickering interrupted.
Operation Windmill, Wagham replied, surprise in his voice. The mission to Fertig.
I never heard it called that before, Pickering said. Where'd you get that?
It was in Admiral Leahy's special channel personal to Admiral Nimitz, Wagham said. In which he said that if we can't provide the kind of a submarine you want, in support of Operation Windmill, and when you want it, he'll want to know our reasons.
Nimitz's special channel personal to me suggests there was a problem with the submarine.
Not from your position, General, but from ours. My orders are to explain the problem to you and pass on Admiral Nimitz's thoughts on the subject, and then to give you whatever you think you need.
Pickering grunted.
I was about to ask if you really thought there might be a microphone in that conference room, Wagham said.
Charlie Willoughby, Pickering replied, is not only about as smart as they come and a thoroughly competent intelligence officer, but is also fiercely loyal to General MacArthur. That's fine for Sweepo and El Supremo, but sometimes it gets in my way.
El Supremo, is that what you call him?
Only behind his back, Pickering said. Wagham laughed.
We have a personal connection, General, he said.
We do?
My nephew, Lieutenant David Schneider, USMC, flew with VMF-229 on Guadalcanal.
Did he come out all right? Pickering asked.
With 5 kills, a DFC, and some injuries to his legs when he barely made it back to Henderson Field in a pretty badly shot-up Wildcat, he is now recovered.
My boy, thank God luck was with him, wasn't injured, Pickering said.
Well, they're both out of it now, at least for a while. An old pal of mine, General McInerney,
I know Mac, Wagham interrupted,
told me the Corps plans to use those kids as instructors, hoping they can pass on what they learned the hard way to the new kids.
He told me the same thing, Wagham said, and that the two of you were in France together. That's how I knew about your son.
Small world. Mac, me, and Colonel Jack, and M.I. Stecker. At the time, we were young enlisted men, foolish enough to believe we were in the war to end war forever.
Me too, Wagham said.
My contribution to World War I was commanding a couple of 3-inchers welded precariously to the superstructure of a freighter. I used to worry about my naval career now that there wasn't going to be another war. I was afraid I would never get to be a commander, much less an admiral.
The two men looked at each other for a moment. Admiral, would there be any problem having Jack Stecker and the lieutenant who's going into the Philippines, his name is McCoy, sit in on our little chat?
I was going to suggest that my aide sit in, Wagham said. He's a submariner. He made 3 trips to Corregidor before it fell. He's suggested that he go along on this operation to see if he could be useful.
Pickering, you've just done it again. Another of your brilliant snap judgments of character is 180 degrees off course.
Fine with me, Pickering said. And the OSS people?
There's only one of them, and I'll tell you about him later, Pickering said.
Mrs. Cavendish removed the luncheon plates from the dining room table, brought in 2 pots of coffee, and left, closing the door softly behind her. General Pickering and Admiral Wagham were at opposite ends of the table. Lining the sides were Colonel Jack and M.I. Stecker, Captain Ed Sessions, Lieutenants McCoy and Hart, USMC, Lieutenant Lewis, USN, and a last-minute addition General Pickering sensed upset Lieutenant Lewis's concept of naval propriety, Staff Sergeant Steve Koffler.
The Navy's wrong about the way they treat and think about their enlisted men, Pickering thought when he saw the shock on Lewis's face after he told Koffler he wanted him present at the meeting. And I wonder where it started. In the Merchant Marine, just about every master, every chief engineer, first goes to sea as an apprentice seaman or an apprentice wiper. The ones with brains and ambition, the ones willing to accept responsibility, are encouraged to think about getting out of the forecastle. The Navy chains the forecastle port shut.
The problem, gentlemen, I should say problems, Admiral Wagham began, are these. SyncPac has available 1 submarine designed to carry cargo. The Narwhal. She is currently undergoing engine refit and some other modifications at Pearl. The operative word there is 1 cargo sub. Her value to the Pacific Fleet goes without saying. He paused and then went on. There is a shortage of standard boats as well. We've taken some pretty bad losses and the sub fleet isn't half as large as we would like. We really can't afford to lose any more.
Tell us what Admiral Nimitz thinks we should do. Pickering interrupted.
All right, Wagham said, and I am in agreement, not only because I work for Admiral Nimitz, but because I've given this problem a good deal of thought. First of all, the risk posed to the Narwhal in this operation is unacceptable, in my opinion.
We need a submarine, Pickering said. What do you suggest?
Wagham did not reply directly. As I understand it, he said, we do not have secure communication with Fertig, and will not have until we put ashore the first personnel and their communications equipment. Until we do that, until Fertig and his people can communicate directly and securely, both with a submarine and with radio stations here and elsewhere, we have no reason to assume that the sub can safely surface, much less discharge cargo, off Mindanao. It's entirely possible that the moment the conning tower breaks water, it will come under shore-based artillery fire.
We plan to go in at night, Admiral, McCoy said.
There are both artillery illuminating rounds and aircraft parachute flares available to the Japanese, Mr. McCoy, Admiral Wagham said reasonably.
Let's hear what you would like us to do, Admiral.